Welcome to the Section 508 Best Practices webinar. Today's webinar is focusing the best practices in federal Section 508 implementation. This is a collaborative program between the CIOC Council, the U.S. Access Board, and the ADA National Network, Great Lakes ADA Center. My name is Claudia Diaz. I'll be assisting Earlene Tusker and Timothy Cregan from the U.S. Access Board. At this time, I want to introduce Earlene Tusker, your moderator for today's session. Earlene?
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Best Practices in Federal Section 508 Implementation Webinar. As Claudia said, this is part of a series, and other presentations from previous shows can be found at the two links that we have listed. One is adaconferences.org/CIOC/archives, or they can also be found at efedlink.org/ALLQUAL/resource-shared-webinars.cfm. And just so we're all on the same page, as I said, this is best practices and what we would consider a best practice. A best practice is a policy, process, procedure, or technique proven effective over time and repeatable by multiple agencies. A best practice is also generalized so that diverse agencies may use it in their own organizations, but specific enough to provide useful guidance and instruction. The CIO Council's Accessibility Community of Practice has published a library of 508 best practices at www.section508.gov. For today's, Section 508 webinar best practice series, we have upcoming dates for the year of 2017. Our webinars are held bi-monthly, as they usually are and will continue to be in 2017. And they will be held January, which is today's, and then again March, May, July, September, and November. The next one is scheduled for March 28, 2017. That topic will be determined. We're working diligently on coming up with that topic for you, and that will be determined sometime before the March 28th webinar. The time will be the usual time between 1, starting at 1 and ending at 2:30. As I said, our future dates and webinar topics are forthcoming. The archives, as mentioned on the previous slide, you can find our archives at the adaconferences.org that I mentioned from the previous slide, as well as the efedlink.org that was also on the previous slide. This webinar is brought to you today with two partners. We have partnered here, the Access Board and the CIO.gov. We have partnered to bring you this series of best practices webinars. And as I've been stating, and as you've heard many times so far today, this is going to be about the Section 508 refresh, ICT final standards and guidelines for 2017. The purpose of the webinar today is to provide a general summary of the ICT final rule that was published on January 18th. Given the time allotted, it will not address all facets of this rule or likely answer every potential question you may have. Nor should this webinar be viewed as offering legal advice on the meaning or application of the rule. What we do hope is that today's webinar affords a helpful overview of the ICT final rule in terms of its organization, structure, and key provisions. Future webinars will go more in depth on discrete topics or areas of interest. With that said, now it's time for me to introduce your two presenters for today. We have Mr. Bruce Bailey and Mr. Timothy Cregan. Mr. Bailey has the lead responsibility for the agency website and with providing technical assistance on Section 508 as the policy relates to websites and software. He has been working for over 20 years in the field of assistive technology and more than 10 of those years in the federal government. Mr. Bailey is also an invited expert with the W3C WAI Web Content Accessibility Guidelines Working Group and an ex officio member of the National Instructional Materials Accessibility Standards Board. Also, he has worked diligently along with Tim Cregan on giving you the 508 and 255 refresh that we will be talking to you about today. Now, Mr. Timothy Cregan is a senior accessibility specialist here at the Access Board. He was the lead staff on the refresh of the Section 508 standards and the Section 255 guidelines. He was formerly the director of consumer training for ITAC, and before that, he was the director of public policy for the Hearing Loss Association of America. Mr. Cregan is a nationally recognized expert on accessible electronic and information technology and telecommunications. And with that said, I will turn it over now to Tim to start the presentation.
Thank you, Rolyn. This is Tim Cregan. Good morning. And we were on slide 16, presentation outline. Today's webinar, since we only have an hour, is intended to be a very high-level overview of the revised Section 508 standards and the revised 255 guidelines. So this slide gives us an overview of the approach we're going to take during today's webinar. First of all, we're going to lead off with an overview of the final rules, structure, and organization. Then we'll talk about key changes and issues that were made from the proposed rule. For those of you who have been following this process, the proposed rule, or the NPRM, was published on the Access and Federal Register, and it's posted on the Access Board website in February of 2015. So we'll talk briefly about the changes that were made between the proposed rule and the final rule. Then, for our next set of discussions, we'll talk about key changes and issues from original 508. Those are the 508 standards that were first published in 2000. And then we'll have an overview of the 508 standards, including some differences in the 255 guidelines. For the purposes of today's presentation only, we are concentrating primarily on Section 508. In future webinars, we will have more detail about the revised Section 255 guidelines. Finally, we'll have a section on resources where you can follow up with any of this material. And then Erlene will be moderating a question and answer session. As Claudia indicated in the beginning, questions may be entered in the chat box in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. Thank you. Next slide, please. Okay, we're on slide 17. This is a timeline of what's called the ICT refresh, which is the process by which the rules were updated. And we're also talking about related W3C activities. W3C is a parent organization that has created the WCAG 2.0 accessibility guidelines and success criteria. And we felt it was important for your understanding of how our revised rule came to be that you see the relationship between activities going on under each organization. So first of all, the Access Board back in February 3rd of 1998 published the original Telecommunications Act Accessibility Guidelines, which we refer to as the Section 255 guidelines. Then, shortly thereafter, the W3C, in May 5th of 1999, they published a final version of WCAG 1.0, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So then after that, the Access Board in December of 2000 published the original Section 508 standards. As we know, when we look at the original Section 508 standards, there are actual references in the notes to the WCAG 1.0 success criteria. So already, even at that early stage, the two rules and the material is following each other, and you can see that there's a lot of common threads that are developing as the concept of accessibility is developed every time. In January 2001, there was the first public working draft of the WCAG 2.0. Bruce Bailey, my colleague, was involved with the development and the work of the WCAG 2.0 success criteria, and he'll be talking about them later in this presentation. Back in July 6, 2006, the Access Board convened their advisory committee to update and revise the Section 508 standards and 255 guidelines. The name of this committee was the Telecommunications, Electronic, and Information Technology Advisory Committee, the TITAC. We had 42 members, including membership from four countries, Japan, Canada, Australia, and the European Union. We also had many stakeholders, consumers, persons with disabilities, members from industry, people from trade associations, people from standard-setting organizations. This whole group of the advisory committee sat together and met every few months over a two-year period. When they completed their work in April of 2008, they presented a final report of recommendations to the Access Board. And that report is posted on the Access Board website. And in that report, they recommended to the board suggested changes or amendments that we could make to our existing Section 508 standards and 255 guidelines. Shortly after that, at the end of the year, in December of 2008, the W3C issued a final version of WCAG 2.0. That was significant because one of the recommendations that the TARTAC made to the Access Board back in April was that we should monitor the rulemaking that was going on under the WCAG 2.0 standards and that we should consider referencing it when the work was completed. So the completion date was significant because it gave us an opportunity to then look at a finalized standard. In March 2010, the Access Board published our first draft proposed rule, known as an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, to update the Section 508 Standards and Telecommunications Act guidelines. That was put out for public notice and comment, and then we put out a second proposed draft, which was the second ANPRM, which was published a little bit over a year later in December of 2011. That also was put out for public notice and comment. Back over at W3C, in May of 2012, the WCAG to ICT Task Force was convened, and they were convened in response to a recommendation we had made in the second ANPRM. And what we had recommended in the second ANPRM was that WCAG 2.0 could be applied potentially to non-web ICT. So the WCAG to ICT Task Force was going to look at our recommendation and see whether that was or was not feasible. In October of 2012, WCAG 2.0 became an ISO or IEC international standard. The number is 40500, the citation year is 2012. Then finally, in September of 2013, the WCAG ICT Task Force, of which Mr. Bailey was a member, produced their guidance on applying WCAG 2.0 to non-web information and communications technology. This was very helpful information, and it was something that the Access Board could look to in developing our proposed rule, or NPRM, which we published in February of 2015. The proposed rule was subject to a notice and comment period, and then once we took cognizance of the comments that people made, we then prepared and submitted the rule to the Office of Management and Budget, where it underwent strenuous interagency review, and the rule was finally approved and published in the Federal Register on January 18th of 2017. So that is an overview of how we got from the beginning till now. Okay, next slide, please. I'm on slide 18, and we're just going to talk about some key points in the rule changes. One of the things we did is we changed the terminology. Those of you who are familiar with the 508 standards remember the terminology electronic and information technology, E&IT. In the revised Section 508 standards, we now, and this revised Section 255 guidelines, we now use the phrase information and communication technology, or ICT, because that is more of the universal phrase and it is more current with current practice. Secondly, again, based on the recommendations of the TARTAC, we are now taking a function-based approach instead of product categories. So, for example, in the 508 rule where it may refer to telecommunications products, today what we focus on is what the function of the product is. So we say that it's ICT with two-way voice communication. Again, because this is a reflection of what's going on in the real world and in the market. Whereas 20 years ago, you may have had a piece of hardware that sat on your desk that was called a telephone, and all it did was provide two-way voice communication. Nowadays, you may carry around in your pocket a small piece of hardware which does multiple things. It allows you to carry on a conversation. It allows you to surf the web. It allows you to send text messages. It allows you to do online research, etc. So for purposes of the revised standard, we refer to the functionality of the ICT. Similarly, ICT with closed functionality replaces the term self-contained closed products. Moving on. Next slide, please. Slide 19. So we've had many changes in the past 17 years, from 2000 to 2017. One of the things you'll notice in this new rule, you will see that we use voluntary consensus standards, which are incorporated by reference within the rule. And the other major change is you will see that we now have something called scoping sections, which impact the application of the technical sections. And now for a further discussion of these materials, I'd like to hand this off to my colleague, Bruce Bailey. Bruce?
Thank you very much, Tim. I'm on slide 20. I'll be in the section of the presentation.
I'm sorry, it's hard to hear, Tim. Tim, if you can get closer, Bruce, see.
I was muted. I've done this so many times. I'm so sorry. Hi, this is Bruce Bailey with the U.S. Access Board. I'm going to be giving the final rule structure and overview very briefly. From my own bad habits, I know I only went to the Federal Register and looked at federal rules when I first came to 508, and so 508 was the only printing, the only rule document that I had ever the first and only one I had ever really paid attention to. And so I was, you know, struck by where's the rule? There's all this preamble stuff. So yes, this follows that kind of format. The rule is at the back as published in the Federal Register, as all regulatory materials are. It's about twice as long as the year 2000 508 rule. So that's a good first impression as well. But it also doesn't use the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulation outline structure. And I'll go to slide 21, please. So we've drawn on, the Access Board has drawn on our extensive experience with having to address requirements, design criteria, for under different statutes, but having one set of design criteria. So we do that under the Architectural Barriers Act and under the Americans with Disability Act, where we have one accessibility guidelines and standards for facilities. It's one document that addresses both statutes. And then the other thing that's different with the ABA, ADA accessibility guidelines, the thing that's different with the ICT standards and guidelines, is that the formatting is similar to industry standard consensus documents, not the CFR outline style, where we go into a lot of detail and we think we've got something that's extremely readable and usable, and the structure and organization is the same as what we've proposed in the the previous NPRMs and the ANPRMs, so it won't be a surprise if you've followed the rulemaking activity, but it would be a surprise if you're familiar with the CFR style and formatting, and then you look at our rule and it's like, what's going on here? So I'll explain that in a little bit more detail. Let's go to slide 22. So each section, we've got the seven chapters, nine chapters, talk about that in a minute. Each chapter, section titles use whole numbers, have a title. Each section will have one or more subsections. The subsections use a number with a decimal point and also have titles. And we may refer to these, if there's nothing underneath them, we may refer to those as provisions. But the subsections themselves may have subsections, and so there could be two or more decimal points. So I'm an example of that. So the major section in this example is 412, ICT with two-way voice communication. The first provision there, or the first section under that, would be 412.1 general. And then the second provision, the second subsection, is 412.2 volume gain. And volume gain has a few subsections underneath it. The first one of those is 14.2.1. So again, the volume gain for wireline telephones. So you can, the drill down there is, I think, apparent. parent. Now, the other thing with this approach is, again, we're getting two statutes, so I have a visual for that in slide 23. So, next slide. So we have a Venn diagram of two intersecting ovals. The left oval is labeled Section 508 Application Scoping, Chapters E1, E2. And the second oval is labeled 255 Application Scoping, Chapters C1 and C2. So the final rule is comprised of both the revised 508 standards and the revised 255 guidelines. In the Code of Federal Regulations, they will appear as appendices to 36 CFR Part 1194. Where they overlap, which is really the bulk of the document, it's shown dark here on my illustration, is Appendix C, FPC, Functional Performance Criteria, and Technical Chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And notice that Chapters 1 for Appendix A is E1 and E2. Chapters 1 and 2 for Appendix B, 255, is C1 and C2. But the common portions don't have the E or the C. Thank you. Go to slide 24. So looking at this a little more like kind of a textual kind of outline, Appendix A, 508, Chapter 1, Application Administration, 508, Chapter 2, Scoping, Appendix B, 255, Chapter 1, Application Administration, 255, Chapter 2, Scoping, Appendix C, Chapter 3, Functional Performance Criteria, Chapter 4, Hardware, Chapter 5, Software, Chapter 6, Support Documentation and Services, Chapter 7, Reference Standards, and then when it's published in the Code of Federal Regulations under 36 CFR Part 1194, the full title being Information and Communication Technology Standards and Guidelines, Appendix D will read, the title is EIT Accessibility Standards as originally published on December 21st, 2000, so the original 508 standards. Those are not in the January 18th printing of the Federal Register. That's just the instructions from the Federal Register to the CFR. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tim.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. This is Tim. I'd like to move on to slide 25. Slide 25, we're now at the next section on our agenda where we're talking about the key changes and issues from the proposed rule. So as we mentioned before, the proposed rule of the NPRM was published on our website in February 2015. And since that was published, and since we reviewed all the comments and underwent review with the Office of Management and Budget, there were some changes that were made between that proposed version of the rule and the final rule. And that's what this section is going to discuss. Next slide, please. Slide 26. Okay. So the three bullet points I want to talk about today about the changes from the 2015 proposed rule are: there is a new safe harbor provision for legacy ICT, and that applies to the revised 508 standards only. There is a changed treatment of real-time text, or RTT, as we originally proposed in the NPRM. And finally, there are changes to the functional performance criteria, the FPC. All right, moving on to the next slide, slide 27. This is the new safe harbor provision in the revised 508 standards. It's section E202.2, and I'm going just to read the text. I wish to mention also there are a couple of underlined words in the text here which are defined elsewhere in the provisions. So the section reads, any component or portion of existing ICT that complies with an earlier standard issued pursuant to Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, as amended, and that has not been altered on or after January 18, 2018, shall not be required to be modified to conform to the revised 508 standards. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, first of all, I'd like to point out in this text, the phrase existing ICT is now has specific meaning, which is defined in the 508 definition sections found at E103.4. Similarly, the word alteration is defined as well. So The revised 508 standards provides this general exception, which is sometimes referred to as a safe harbor, that permits existing ICP in whole or in part to remain as it is, so long as it meets certain conditions. So under E202.2, unaltered existing ICP, including electronic content that complies with the original 508 standards, does not need to be modified or upgraded to conform to the revised 508 standards. By incorporating a self-harbor for legacy ICT into the revised 508 standards, the Access Board was responding to agencies' concerns about the potential resources required to remediate existing ICT, including agency websites or other public-facing legacy documents. It's also important to note that the safe harbor applies on an element-by-element basis, and that each component or portion of existing ICT is evaluated separately. The safe harbor provision references component or portion of existing ICT because it only protects those aspects of ICT that conform to the original standards. So, for instance, if you have a web page that conforms to the original 508 standards, but you have a non-caption embedded video, that video does not conform to the existing 508 standards. So therefore, that video is not protected by the safe harbor provision, and it must be made compliant with the revised 508 standards. However, the rest of the page, having conformed to the original standards as of January 18, 2018, would not need to meet the revised standards until it is altered. So, again, we talked about the existing definitions. So existing ICT, as defined at E103.4, is defined as ICT that has been procured, maintained, or used on or before January 18, 2018. That's the definition for existing ICT. And we specifically did not include ICT that has been developed but not used before this date. And the reason for that is that ICT in development still presents the opportunity to conform to the technical requirements of the revised 508 standards. The other definition that's crucial in understanding this section is the word alteration. And an alteration, again, is defined in E103.4 for the purposes of this section, is a change to existing ICT that affects interoperability, the user interface, access to information and data. Now, we will have further technical assistance and information on all these provisions. Today's webinar is just intended to introduce you to the concepts and give you a high-level overview. So I'd like to move on now to the next major change from the proposed rule, which is the treatment of real-time text. So in the NPRM, we have proposed certain language in the text to apply to real-time text. In this final rule, we have reserved that material, and it is found at 412.5 as a placeholder. The reason for this is because the Federal Communications Commission, which has concurrent jurisdiction with us, has an ongoing rulemaking on real-time text, and so we are deferring to that FCC rulemaking. On December 16, 2016, the FCC issued a report and order called Petition for Rulemaking to Update the Commission's Rules for Access to Support the Transition from TTY to Real-Time Text Technology, and Petition for Waiver of Rules Requiring Support of TTY Technology. For an explanation, next slide, please. So now we're on slide 29, and what this is, this is a quick summary of what the real-time text report in order addresses. And for our purposes today, there's four major points. First of all, it addresses the transition from TTY technology to real-time text technology that permits simultaneous voice and text on the same call using the same device. Secondly, interoperability between systems is achieved by adhering to the standard RFC 4103 as a safe harbor standard. Third, the report and order requires backwards compatibility with TTYs. In other words, the TTY technology must be supported for a specified period of time. And finally, fourth, There will be support for real-time text transmissions from 911 call centers and telecommunications relay centers. There is more detail in the report and order, but those are the four points we wanted to emphasize today. Next slide. We're now on slide 30. It's important to remember that the requirements for real T2Ys and real-time text are in transition. So the Access Board continues to monitor these proceedings and plans to update the 508 standards and 255 guidelines as appropriate in a future rulemaking. So there are no TTY requirements in the revised 508 standards for the time being. The TTY compatibility is still required under current 255 requirements as enforced by the FCC. We must remember that this does not affect ongoing agency obligations to provide access under 501 and 504. Okay, next slide, please. Finally, we come to the third bullet point, which was the changes to the functional performance criteria, the FPC. Okay, so the existing 508 standards do have functional performance criteria, and so the final rule has changes. And so we added an FPC to address cognitive accessibility. That would be section number 302.9. This is new to the revised 508 standards. It's already in the section 255 guidelines. And it was done in response to commenters and also to harmonize with the European Union standard for accessibility, which is referenced as EN301549. So we're very happy with this development. We think this is a significant advance and look forward to further technical assistance on this point. In addition, the FPC for limited hearing, 302.5, and limited vision, 302.2, were modified in response to comments to the NPRM. And we have recast them to be more closely harmonized with the EN301549 standard. Next slide, please. So slide 32, the role of the FPC, in addition to the text of the provisions, the role of the FPC is clarified. What we've done is made it clear that the use of the FPC is consistent with past and current practices. So the functional performance criteria are applicable when the technical requirements in chapters 4 and 5 do not address the functions of the ICT. So if you have ICT that does not conform to your technical requirements, you use the FPC to evaluate it. All right, next slide, slide 33. Okay, so when the ICT does not conform to your technical requirements, the functional performance criteria are the basis for evaluating whether or not you have equivalent facilitation. You will remember existing 508 provides for equivalent facilitation, and so do the revised 508 standards. And so the FPC are used to determine whether substantially equivalent or greater accessibility is being provided. So again, when the ICT features do not conform to the technical requirements, you test those features against the FPC. And when, conversely, when the ICT has features that do conform to the technical requirements in chapters 4 and 5, you don't need to apply the FPC. And again, this is consistent with past and current practice. Okay, at that point, I would now like to turn over discussion of the next portion of this presentation about changes from the original Section 508 standards to Bruce. Bruce?
Thank you, Tim. This is Bruce again. I'll be talking about key changes and issues from original 508. If you're, again, the kind of the orientation is if you're just looking at the final rule for the first time and that you're familiar with the original 508 standards. And of course, the three topics that Tim just spoke about are, of course, relevant to these changes. There's a lot of similarities, a lot of exact parallels. For example, the general exceptions in original 508 are in the final rule. This is not a detailed analysis of the original and revised 508 side by side. Slide 35, please. So for this topic, portion of the program, there's three topics I am going to highlight in comparing the final rule to the 2000 original 508 standards. One is the broad application of WCAG 2.0, including what do I mean by covered content, the delineation of covered content, a long topic in the preamble. I'm going to be highlighting ICT with closed functionality as a particular example of things, some of the things that are changed, and answer a question about what are we requiring about mobile. So the first topic, slide 36, please. The broad application of WCAG 2.0. We are requiring the WCAG Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0 level A and level AA success criteria and the conformance requirements make the formal citation to WCAG 2.0. When we're applying those requirements to web content, covered non-web documents, and software user interfaces. This is a similar approach that is used elsewhere, including the EN 301549 standard. We make the IBR citation the reference. We don't reprint WCAG 2.0 as they do in the EN document. And our approach is consistent with the proposals in the second advance notice, the second ANPRM, and what we proposed in the notice of proposed rulemaking and responsive to comments and commenters that we've received. Next slide, 37, please. I have kind of a Venn diagram illustration of that concept. So we've got a large circle labeled 508 rule that overlaps with a medium-sized circle labeled WCAG 2.0. Inside the WCAG 2.0 circle are three smaller circles labeled A, AA, and AAA. The A and AA circles are also inside the large 508 circle, but the AAA circle, which is inside of WCAG, of course, lays outside the 508 rule. And this illustration would be more complete if I had the conformance requirements and the definitions and such. But the main point is that there's a good bit of material that's in WCAG 2.0 that is not relevant to the 508-255 rule. And there's quite a large amount of material that's in the 508-255 rule that has nothing to do with WCAG, since WCAG is only about the web content. Next slide, 38, please. I'd like to show you where we do the WCAG incorporation by reference. The specific citations are mostly in the chapters 2, which is why it's important to look at that chapter. 508 chapter 2, the citation number is E205.4, accessibility standards, which is under electronic content. And then again, the next paragraph next section down, a couple sections down, E207.2, WCAG conformance under E207 software. Then in Chapter 5, software, which we're not going into detail today, we will go and talk about the software requirements in a future webinar, is 504 authoring tools as a reference to WCAG 2.0. And then in Chapter 6, Support Documentation and Services, under 602.3, Electronic Support Documentation, there's a citation to WCAG 2.0. Slide 39, please. I'd like to give the example of the specific citation. The number is E205.4, so again, the E, this is only a 508-only citation, accessibility standard. Electronic content shall conform to level A and AA success criteria and conformance requirements in WCAG 2.0 incorporated by reference C702.10.1. So that's our section language, very legalese but very understandable as well. The 702.10.1 is a reference to Chapter 7, the reference standards. Now, E205.4 continues, which I'm not going to read verbatim today, but there's exceptions for non-web documents from the four success criteria from WCAG 2.0 that deal with sets of web pages. So if I'm talking about a page within a set of web pages, there's four success criteria in WCAG that describe or lay out the requirements for what features must be particular to a page within a set of web pages. That concept was highly problematic for the WCAG to ICT task force that deliberated for a couple years that Tim mentioned at the beginning of the show. So, and, you know, commenters had a lot to say about the way we were making the direct reference. So where we ended up in the final rule is that we have an exception for those four success criteria. And again, that's similar to what they've done with the European 301549 approach. And then another comment that we got more than once was that we couldn't, the proposed rule, people were not comfortable with the citation to WCAG for web content to non-web documents. They wanted more detail. So in the final rule, we have provided that. E205.4.1 gives the mechanics of the word substitution that you need to go do to read WCAG 2.0 for non-web documents. It's really pretty straightforward. You can do a search and replace in a word processor, for example, but it's important that the final rule have that detail in it. And so that's what that possibly, you know, a little bit of a lengthy way that we want to write that all out. Slide 40, please. A very similar thing happens in E207.2, the WCAG conformance. Instead of saying electronic documents, it says user interface components. User interface components, as well as the content of platforms and applications, shall conform to level A and AA success criteria and conformance requirements in WCAG 2.0, incorporated by reference, C702.10.1. Again, that's the full formal citation. It goes on after that section to have about the exception for the same four success criteria. This is a description of the word substitution. The word substitution doesn't work quite as well for software as it did for non-web documents to web page, so we ended up having to rewrite conformance requirement 3. So that's why E207.2 is longer than E205.4. So it's the same approach, software instead of documents. The mechanics are a little bit more complex, so they're all written out there. And then there's also an exception for software that is assistive technology, because one of the things we don't want to do is make it more difficult than should be for agencies to get software. Let me compare what we do in 255. Next slide, please. So the WCAG 2.0 incorporation by reference of the 255 guidelines also happens in the two places, electronic content, and then for software, C203.1 is nearly identical to what we saw in E205.4. But we need to be careful with our scoping, so instead of just electronic content shall conform, it is electronic content that is integral to the use of telecommunications or customer premises equipment. So that is a quite important concept, integral to the use of telecommunications or customer premises equipment. So that's the difference there. The software citation under 255, C205.2, is identical to E207.1. So under 508, next slide please, slide 42, we needed to delineate what is covered content. And again, this is only 508 that this was necessary. So there's two sections that deal with that, E205.2, public facing. Electronic content that is public facing shall conform. That's the same, exactly the same as what we have 508. 508, original 508 covers internet sites. E205.3, official agency communication, that's just the title, but it addresses content that is not public facing and describes official agency communication in 9 categories. We didn't think we could do all documents all the time everywhere that any single part of the document that any federal employee happened to touch, but it was important to net up lots of things that get circulated in email in a very explicit and clear way, so we've done that. And then there's an exception for the National Archives Records Administration, that if, as they get records from agencies, they are not required to retrofit them for accessibility. Slide 43. So what do we mean by agency official communication, E205.3? We list out 9 general categories of content. These are not, you know, these are not meant to be taken as specific, and as the preamble describes, are not specific regulatory actions or anything like that. They are, you know, phrased as general categories. So A is an emergency notification. B, an initial or final decision adjudicating an administrative claim or proceeding. C, an internal or external program or policy announcement. D, a notice of benefits, program eligibility, employment, opportunity, or personnel action. E, a formal acknowledgement or receipt, or of receipt. F, a survey questionnaire. In the NPRM, this was survey or questionnaire. We really mean this just as a, you know, a something when it's collecting PIA, private information, a survey questionnaire. G, a template or form. These were very important when for developing, starting out your word processing documents, you know, that those templates start off at an accessible format. That is a format that's conforming to WCAG 2.0, level AA. H, education or training materials. Education and training materials being called out in the original 2000 standards. I, intranet, not internet, intranet content designed as a web page. And again, original 508.1194.22 applies to intranet content. So nothing new there. It's just consistent with that. So in terms of topics, what's changed, let's go to 44, ICT with closed functionality. This section is one of the lengthier sections. It does have, of course, the same parallel to the original 508 that had provisioned a whole section for self-contained closed functionality of products with self-contained closed functionality. There are five subsections. Some of those are lengthy. But the big thing is that we now have the explicit requirement for speech output. Current original 508 only said that the self-contained closed products be usable by people with disabilities. As we've, you know, seen in the last 15, 16, 17 years, that really does mean something that's natively speech-enabled. So that's one of the sections within 402. 402.2, speech output enabled. ICT with a display screen shall be speech output enabled for full and independent use by individuals with vision impairments. There's six exceptions to that, so we get at ICT that has maybe limited capabilities, limited RAM, limited processing power, and there's five sub-provisions or subsections of E, of not E, of 402.2. So this gets is a nice segue into the next topic, because one of the types of things of ICT with closed functionality is the phone, either your desk phone or your mobile phone. So let's go to slide 45, please. So what about mobile? We've had multiple requests for, but we do not have a separate chapter or section for mobile. But mobile technology was very much at the top of our minds, just taken into account throughout the development of the rule, throughout the rulemaking process. It just didn't make sense for us to have a separate section or chapter for mobile. Mobile phones are covered under hardware, so see Chapter 4 Hardware. All of the requirements there work well for desk phones. They work well for mobile phones. And a lot of mechanics of that is because there's some inline exceptions to some of the requirements that they work. And then the same thing about, you know, what do we say about mobile apps? Well, mobile apps are software, so they're covered under software. So see Chapter 2 citation to WCAG 2.0 for software, the E207.2 or the C205.2. There are a little bit of caveats in there, but it's pretty much the Chapter 5 software chapter works for mobile apps. So see Chapter 5 software. So then this kind of begs the question, 46, do phones have to be speech output enabled? And the answer is different depending on if we're talking about 255 or 508. So the scoping requirements under 508 and under 255 are different. Under 508, all of 402 closed functionality applies, including 402.2 for speech output enabled. So we expect our federal agencies, the requirement is to procure mobile phones that are voice out, speech output enabled. And we have that. Those are commercially available. So there are choices out there, you know, both with the Apple product and the Android product, the VoiceOver and the TalkBack features. Individuals who are blind are happy with both of those phones, and they're accessible. So that's more than reasonable to have a requirement for that for federal agencies. And 255, it applies to every phone out there. So there's exceptions, including there's a C under C, and again, Chapter 2, C204 hardware, and 402 is listed as one of the exceptions. So we do not, under 255, say that in the GARA guidelines require that phones be required to be speech output enabled. Going on to slide 47, I want to talk about 402 closed functionality a little bit more. And again, because of the exception, this is only Section 508. Closed functionality applies to ICT, such as phones and kiosks. For your desk phones, there's, again, the exceptions for products with limited RAM or capability or processor power. But for and then for several provisions in Chapter 4, have exceptions for personalized ICT. And the example I like to call out there is 402.2.5 for Braille instructions. Exception, devices for personal use shall not be required to conform to 402.2.5. So no, we're not requiring Braille labels for initiating the speech phone on federal ICC phones. Next slide, please, 48. I want to review the Section 255 guideline scoping exceptions related to self-contained closed and all of the hardware chapter. ICT covered by Section 255 is generally required to comply with the technical requirements, that is, the chapters 4 through 7. But under 255 only, there are hardware exceptions for closed functionality, 402. There's also an exception for tactile orientation of tickets and fare cards, 4077, that's never going to be applicable to a phone. There's an exception for reach, range, height, and depth, 407.8, again, never going to be applicable to something that's sitting, a small thing that's sitting on your desk or holding in your hand. And there's an exception for display screen visible from a seated height, 408, because again, it's not fixed equipment, it's never applicable to a phone. And then finally, there's an exception for user controls for caption and audio description 415, because again, as with the speech output enabled, it's not widely available and not appropriate for 255, but perfectly appropriate for 508. So now to give you the speed run overview of the standard, I'll turn it back to my colleague, Tim.
Thank you, Bruce. Okay, this is Tim. We're now on slide 49, overview of the 508 standard. We're now at the last major bullet of the material for today, where we're talking about an overview of the 508 standard. And so for the next several slides, what I'm going to do is just go over the structure of the rule itself. In other words, I'm going to identify all of the major sections in the rule. And I would invite those of you either who are online now or who have an opportunity afterwards, please feel very free to go to the Access Board website at www.access-board.gov and take a look at what Bruce and I have been talking about today. You'll find it under, there are several links. There's a link for ICT Refresh, which will lead you to a link called Final Rule. And when you click on that, what you'll see is the Final Rule document. And I want to emphasize that what Bruce and I have been talking about are the text provisions, the technical requirements and the functional performance requirements of the new rule. There is a tremendous amount of explanatory material in the what's called the preamble of the final rule, where we explain where certain provisions originated, what was the reason, what were the comments that influenced our decision making. And that may be very helpful to those of you out there who are wondering why we took a particular approach. As Bruce has indicated, some of the approaches were dictated by changes in technologies. It has been 17 years, after all. Other changes were dictated by recommendations by commenters. So let's take a look. Moving on to slide 50. Thank you, Elaine. Now, we have the overview of the Section 508 standards. Now, these are the seven chapters that the technical and functional performance criteria of the rule are organized by. Chapter 1, which we've talked about, is the application and administration. So the application and administration contains such things as the definitions. You will recall I made reference back to 103.4, where there was the defined terms section, for example. It also defined how the rule applies. It applies to federal agencies and so forth. Chapter 2 is the scoping provisions. Bruce has just been talking about that, and I've been talking about that. And so the scoping provisions help identify where for particular types of ICT, whether it's hardware, whether it's software, whether it's content, what technical and functional performance criteria may apply to it. So the scoping chapters are always important when you're approaching the rule and you're looking to do, for example, looking at ICT and trying to say, well, what are the technical provisions that would apply to this ICT? A good place to start is Chapter 2, which addresses what's covered and where. Chapter 3 are your functional performance criteria. Those, remember, you use when you have no technical provisions that address your ICT, or you want to make sure, you want to confirm what you're proposing to do provides equivalent facilitation or access that is equivalent to or greater than the access provided by the use of the technical specification. So that's what you would look to the functional performance criteria for. And remember, there are nine functional performance criteria in the final rule. Chapter 4, hardware, again, our scoping requirements for hardware. Bruce talked about some of the requirements, how the hardware requirements apply to a desktop phone just like they can apply to a mobile phone. They can also apply to a multifunction copier. Those are just some of the examples of how the hardware provisions would be applied. Chapter 5, software, again, or the apps, as Bruce noted. You could be talking about the software on your mobile phone. You could be talking about the software in a desktop computer. You could be, anywhere you're going to be inquiring about software, this is the chapter we're going to go to look for the technical provisions. Chapter 6 is your support documentation and services. And Chapter 7 are the reference standards that we're actually incorporating. And it also tells you in Chapter 7 where to find those standards. Now let's take a little deeper dive into some of the details of these chapters. Next slide, please. So slide 51, Section 508 requirements for Chapters 1 and 2. What we have here on one slide are all of the sections for Chapter 1 under Section 508 requirements and all of Chapter 2 for Section 508. So in Chapter 1, again, which we've said is Application Administration, there's Section E101, General. The E is the prefix which applies to those specific sections which apply to the 508 rule. Similarly, when we're talking about the Section 255 guidelines under the 255 rule, the provisions will have a prefix of C for communication. So in 508, all the scoping and application chapter provisions will say E in front of them. So we have E101 general, followed by E102 reference standards, and then E103 definitions. In the Chapter 2 scoping requirements, we have E201 application, E202 exceptions, and many of the exceptions are statutory, and they'll be very familiar to those of you who are familiar with the existing 508 standards. For example, you're all familiar with the exception for national security systems. Well, that same exception is in the final rule. So that's just an example of general exceptions which are found at E202. E203, access to functionality, is a section where it clarifies that agencies have a continuing responsibility to provide access to functionality to ICT. E204, again, is the scoping provision for the functional performance criteria, where it's reiterating that if the technical provisions of the chapters do not apply, then you look to the functional performance criteria. E205 content, as Bruce talked about that, when we talked about in electronic content, the public-facing electronic content, as well as the 9 covered categories of electronic content. So for those of us content creators, so whether you are drafting a memo, or you're creating a PowerPoint show, or any sort of electronic content, you want to make sure to look at the scoping for E205. E206, hardware, we talked again, the examples we used were mobile phones, multifunction copier printers, desktop phones, desktop laptops, that kind of thing. Those requirements are found there. E207, the software requirements. And then finally, in E208, we have support documentation and services. So again, this is a high-level overview of your scoping. You're always going to want to start here when you start looking at your 508 requirements. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. Next slide, okay, we're on slide 52. You're going to be in your functional performance criteria. Okay, so this chapter is set up, again, very similarly. The first section is almost always titled General. So in this case, it's 301, General. You'll notice it does not have a prefix. It doesn't say E or S. It just has a number. That's because the Section 508 standards and the 255 guidelines look to chapters 3 through 7, and they determine by the scoping what applies when. So these are the standalone technical and functional performance criteria. So in this chapter, we have the general statement, and then under 302, we have the 9 specific functional performance criteria. These will be very familiar to those of you who have used the existing 508 standards with the changes we talked about earlier. So 302.1, without vision.
Tim?
302.
Tim, let me interrupt you for 1 second. Interpreter, if you could slide back
sure.
A couple of inches. Your hands are falling below the view in the camera. Thank you. If you could scoot back a little bit so that we can get a little bit more view of your hands. Okay, can we do a testing? 1, 2, 3, interpreter. Make sure your hands are in view. Okay. We're good to go, Tim.
Okay. All right, thank you. So we were just talking about provision E, 302.2 with limited vision. When you look at it, and we're not going into the detail of the language for all the provisions today, but we did mention that 302.2 with limited vision and then 302.4 without hearing, those were amended from the proposed rule from the NPRM to more closely align with the work of the European Commission in E301549. So E302.3 without perception of color is very similar to the existing language in the 508 standards. 302.4 without hearing. 302.5 with limited hearing. So again, that's one that was altered from the NPRM. 302.6 without speech. 302.7 with limited manipulation. 302.8 with limited reach and strength. Again, these are very familiar from the prior version of the rule. And then 302.9 with limited language, cognitive, and learning disabilities. This is new to the rule as a result of the comments we received. And we will be providing more technical assistance in depth on all of these sections. Next slide, please. Chapter 4, hardware. Chapter 4 is a fairly long chapter. It has a number of provisions. It has 15 major sections. 401, general. 402, closed functionality, like Bruce talked about. We used to refer to this as self-contained closed products. Now we talk about it as a feature of the ICT. 403, biometrics, has been a fairly consistent recommendation from the early days of the TITAC report that we include alternative ways of providing personal identification and details in the provision itself. 404, the preservation of information provided for accessibility. It's clarifying existing practices, 405 privacy, 406 standard connections, 407 operable parts. 407 operable parts is interesting because it has developed over the course of rulemaking that we felt that it was important to have a specific series of sections addressing this because it was important to explain how they fit in the different contexts. So when you take a look at that, I would suggest you also particularly look at the discussion of that in the preamble. 408 display screens, Bruce mentioned that before. That's under the hardware chapter, as we're saying. It also can be relevant to different types of products. When you think about it, different types of ICT that have display screens. 409 status indicators, 410 color coding, 411 audible signals, and 412 ICT with two-way voice communication, again reflecting the changed terminology from the original 508 standards. 413 closed caption processing technologies, 414 audio description processing technologies, and then 415 talks about the user controls by which we access those types of technologies for captions and audio descriptions. Again, all of the changes and the language we'll see in this chapter were developed as a result of public comments to our various drafts of the rule. Next slide, please. Okay, we're on slide 54, which is software. Again, the first provision, the first section is 501 General. Section 502, interoperability with assistive technology. This is probably a section that's going to deserve its own webinar all by itself. It's very complex. It addresses a lot of concerns that people have had as to how assistive technology and software interoperate. For those of you who wish to, there's an extensive discussion of this in the preamble. And again, we will be having further technical assistance and webinars on this topic. 503 is section on applications, and 504, as Bruce mentioned, is section on authoring tools. Okay. Moving on to the next slide. Chapters 6 and 7, which are the last two chapters in the rule. Chapter 6 is the support documentation and services. Again, it has first provision is always section 601, general. Section 602 addresses support documentation. 603 addresses support services. Remember, the scoping for each of these chapters is found in Chapter 2, and then the technical provisions that apply will be found in the chapter itself. And then finally, you have Chapter 7, which is the reference standards. Again, the first section is 701 General, and the second section is 702, incorporation by reference, which lists all of the 10 reference standards that we are referencing and how you can get hold of a copy of one of those standards. All right, moving on, let's see, where are we now? We're on slide 56. Very, very quick comparison back. Remember Bruce showed us the chart where we saw there were appendices A, B, C, and D in the new rule, the new final rule. So there's appendices A, which is the 508 revised standards, and appendix B, which is the revised 255 guidelines. Both of them, for their chapters one, they both have the same provision titles, general, reference standard, and definitions. Please keep in mind that some of the definitions listed only appear in one rule or the other, but not both. Okay, moving on. Next slide, please. Comparison of appendices, again, A and B, A 508 and B 255 for their chapters two. Each of them have an application section. There's E201 application for the revised 508 standards and the C201 application for the revised 255 guidelines. Now, where they differ, section 508 revised standards, chapter 2, has a section for general exceptions, E202, and access to functionality, E203. Where Section 255 does not have these specific sections. And the reason for that is because the two rules are not the same. And so, although there's parallel structure in a lot of these cases, each of the rules has an outline that is specific to the content of that rule itself. And finally, the provisions E204 through E208 correspond to the provisions in scoping chapters C202 through C206. So in this case, 204 through 208 talks about your scoping. E204 is your functional performance criteria scoping, and 205 is your electronic content. E206 is your hardware. E207 is your software. E208 is your support documentation services. Similarly, in 255, C205, the scoping is for C202, functional performance criteria, C203, electronic content, C204, hardware, C205, software, C206, support documentation and services. So you see the similarity and you see the pattern, as we talked about earlier, and we're just repeating that for your benefit here. Next slide. I'll now turn this over to our moderator, Erlene Sestra. Erlene?
Okay, and I want to thank everyone for staying with us. And now what I'm going to discuss with you over the next three slides are resources that are available with this actual series and in helping with your best practices for your ICT for the 508 standards. And first we have, of course, the Access Board, and that's www.access-board.gov. And there you will be able to access the Section 508 standards and Section 255 guidelines. You'll have technical assistance. The ICT Final Rule 2017 is there, webinars, the archive for the best practices, and then more guidance material that's currently under development. Additionally, you could go to w3.org/PR/WCAG-WCAG 2.0 materials. And there you will see WCAGA 2.0 guidelines and success criteria, understanding WCAG WCAG 2.0 technical assistance, techniques for WCAG 2.0 technical assistance, and customizable and interactive quick references for technical assistance. Also, you could go to www.section508.gov. That's GSA website. It's got 508 technical assistance. They're frequently asked questions, best practices on how to make Word documents accessible, Excel spreadsheets, and information for PDFs. Also, there's www.ada.gov/PCA toolkit/CHAP5toolkit.htm, and it's the ADA toolkit for state and local government entities. You could also go to www.cio.gov, which will give you CIO's Accessibility Committee Best Practices, Education and Vendor Subcommittees, and also the Education and Vendor Subcommittees for Section 508. After giving you that information, now what we're going to attempt to do is answer some of your questions that have come in as Tim and Bruce have been talking. Okay? And we have one that's asking, is every change considered an alteration under the Safe Harbor provision?
Erlene, I'd like to address that if I may. This is Tim. So as I talked about earlier, you remember in the presentation we talked about E202.2, which is the new provision on Safe Harbor. Okay, so even if you changed existing ICT, that change may or may not be considered an alteration that would remove the existing ICT from the Safe Harbor. Again, an alteration for the purpose of this section is a change to existing ICT that affects interoperability, the user interface, or access to information and data. And remember that it's defined in E103.4, which is the scoping chapter for Section 508, administration and definitions. So, for example, if you were to deploy a security patch that doesn't interfere, that does not affect your interoperability, or your user interface, or the access to information, then the deployment of that security patch would not be considered an alteration for the purposes of the Safe Harbor. So therefore, you would not have to change anything. correction of a typo, for example, if you had a mistyped word on a page. That's an example of a change that would not be considered an alteration because the information you're providing is the same. Remember, you have to change the existing ICT in a way that affects the interoperability, the user interface, or the access to the information or data. So obviously, if you're fixing a misspelling, you're improving the access, you're not changing it. The addition of text, now let's say you added words that provided new information would affect the access to the information. So let's say you added some additional paragraphs explaining something. That additional text would be an alteration, and you would need then to comply with the technical requirements of the revised 508 standards.
Okay. We have another question. And the question is, if ICT, if you have current ICT and it's only partially complied with, would those components that did not comply now be subject to the new standard?
Okay. Now, again, if we're evaluating this under the E202.2, the safe harbor provision, safe harbor, remember, applies on an element-by-element basis. So each component, the portion of existing ICT is evaluated separately. So the safe harbor provision only protects the aspects of ICT that conform to the original standards. Portions not conforming to the original standards as of January 18, 2018 would need to meet the revised standards.
Okay. We have another question. Maybe you can help us with this one, Bruce. Are mobile phones required to be speech output enabled?
As I described in the slide on that, can we go back a few, several slides? Or is that
sure? Do you know what slide?
Yes. Hold on. It's you want to go to slide 45.
Thank you. Go to the next one, please. So,
forward,
please. 46. 47. I have a question right there on the slide about what do they have to talk? 46.
Okay. So we're now back on to slide 46.
So it's different under 255, under 508. Under 508, phones are required to the self-contained close. Section 402 is applicable. So one of the first elements there is about speech output enabled. So yes, the mobile phones that federal agencies procure need to be able to talk, so that an individual who's blind can use them. We have carefully crafted the requirements so that, for example, you're not required to have a hard keyboard on your mobile phone, which the modern smartphones are accessible and don't have many physical buttons at all. So with the original 2000 508 phones, it's really hard to argue that a iPhone or an accessible Android phone meets that specification on its face unless you resort to equivalent facilitation. But with the current standards, they meet the modern accessible smartphones meet the technical standards straight up. Under 255, we don't include that. So there's nothing in the revised 255 guidelines that requires the speech output enabled.
Okay.
And what's the question about phones or I thought I heard smartphones in particular.
Well, it just said mobile phones.
Yes.
Okay.
We're not requiring your desktop phones necessarily to be speech output enabled. They don't need to be. Somebody who's blind can use a plain old telephone perfectly well, thank you. But if you read through the technical requirements in Chapter 4, it delineates when things have to talk and when they can just be usable from tactile only controls.
Okay. We have a couple of questions about VPAT, and I'm just going to combine them into one. And basically the question is there an updated VPAT available to reflect the latest revisions? And if not, are there plans to have an updated?
Okay. The VPAT document, the Voluntary Product Accessibility Template, that's not a government or a GSA or anything document. That was an industry response from the Industry Technology Information Council. Am I getting that name correct, Tim? That developed the VPATs initially. The government's been pretty accepting those as a reporting mechanism. So we don't have any control or enforcement over that. We don't. Our standard is not requiring VPATs. We don't refer to VPATs in there. Our understanding is that ITIC is working to update them, yes, but I can't give you any dates, and you'd have to ask them.
Okay.
I will mention that GSA is actively working on updating the Bi-Accessible Wizard and their products to support the new standards. We don't have hard dates on that.
Okay. Here's YKWCAG. I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but we have a couple of questions. I'm going to combine them again. Bruce.
First question is, there's no wrong way to
say it. Okay. Okay. That's the first. Thank you, Bruce. And what we have, the questions are dealing with the NPR. I mean, they say we reference eliminating in the 1194.22 BIM pertaining to style sheets. It talked about a reference of eliminating style sheets, scripting, and applets. And they wanted to know, they say the best web experience includes various scripting techniques. So can you clarify if things such as the scripting are going to be officially eliminated?
So there's no, in current original 508, you've got 22D, L, and M that mention technologies like style sheets and scripting and applets. WCAG 2.0 is not organized that way. WCAG 2.0 is technology neutral, as they explained in the introduction to WCAG. And it's equally applicable to style sheets and scripting and applets as it is to HTML. It applies to all the content, and the content's required to conform. So you absolutely can use any or all of those technologies. So it's not really accurate to say D, L, and M have been eliminated. That, you know, the requirements there, it's just that you can't do a one-to-one mapping between 22, let's say, M and something in WCAG, because all of WCAG applies to applets and plugins and such. You know, a related question I get is, okay, so does this mean that I have to make sure pages work when JavaScript is turned off? Well, you know, there never was a requirement in under original 508 that pages work with JavaScript disabled, and WCAG does not require that pages work with JavaScript disabled. The requirement is for JavaScript to conform.
Okay. We have another question here. When will education and training live streaming events need to have CART, the Communication Access Real-Time Translation?
Okay, this is Tim. Okay, so for those of you who aren't familiar, the CART is a specific type of real-time captioning technology, and to the extent possible, we never try to require a specific technological solution. We never talk about a brand name. So instead, what we want to say is that, first of all, educational and live streaming events are already required to be captioned. In the original Section 508 standards, you have your provision 1194.24c, and the revised standards don't change that. In 1195.24c, the emphasis added, I would want to say, all training, and informational video and multimedia productions which support the agency's mission, regardless of format, that contain speech or other audio information necessary for the comprehension of content, shall be open or closed caption. So the answer to your question is, you do have to caption it. The technology or the methods you use to caption it is up to you. CART is probably the most popular and practical way to provide those captions, but it's not specifically required.
Okay. Here's another question. Chapter 6 support documentation does not contain the four exceptions for documents from E205.4. Are these four exceptions not applicable if a document is a support document?
So this is Bruce again. Those four exceptions are about from WCAG 2.0, where WCAG 2.0 talks about a web page within a set of web pages. And the reason that Chapter 6 doesn't mention that exception is because the chapter, you know, you've got to read the very first section in Chapter 6 that provides the scoping. So the support referenced in 602.3 can be either for web or non-web, and then you have to go back to either E205, back to Chapter 2, or C203 to see if those four exceptions are applicable. So they're, it's not an error that they're not in Chapter 6. It's just that you've got to look at the reference and take into account the scoping. So if your online support documentation is web content, those four success criteria are applicable. If your support documentation is non-web documents, then they're not. But that's done in Chapter 2. It's not done in Chapter 6.
Okay, here's going to throw you all a softball, I think. Okay, here we go. Do these new guidelines apply to public school websites?
This is Tim. I'll take a whack at that. This is a good example of, remember we've been talking about Chapter 1 application and Chapter 2 scoping. You would, assuming you'd never heard of Section 508, you didn't know how it applies, you would go to your Chapter 1 and you would read that Section 508 only applies to federal agencies. So again, an important aspect of these new rules is you have to think about how you're going to use them. So you always want to go see through your scoping and application administration chapters and see what applies where. Then you go to your technical requirements.
Okay. Looks like we have time for at least one more question, and that is, will simulators, emulators, trainers, and part task trainers that incorporate computers, examples such as air traffic controller simulator, medical emergency trauma simulator, flight simulator, radio networks, need to comply with this rule? Can you answer this one for us, Bruce?
Again, you do have the general exceptions about, national security systems, for example, but that doesn't necessarily, just because the simulators might be for a national security system or a flight simulator, or might be used by a DOD entity or something like that, and again, we're talking about 508 here, that doesn't hold that every software they buy isn't covered, and in fact, education stuff is covered, and simulators and all those things that the participant listed, you know, those are all generally covered, and there's not specific exceptions for them. That said, it isn't, you know, the current requirements, also original 508 requirements apply to them as well. With both the original 508 requirements and using WCAG in the revised standards, there's exceptions that are kind of in line with with the success criteria. So there's these inline exceptions that are different from those broad general exemptions, I'll call them this time. Okay. So for example, with success criteria 1.1.1, it has an exception for non-text content that is primarily intended to create a specific sensory experience. So if your flight simulator is just showing you a live simulation of what you're seeing out of the front screen of the airplane, the front window of the airplane, that's not something that you have to try and come up with non-text equivalent for. You just have to have it identified. So that requirement works as is. Another example is with Success Criteria 2.1.1, which is about the keyboard accessibility, and it has an exception built into it which says, except where the underlying function requires input that depends on the path of the user's movement. Now that's a mouthful. Input that depends on the path of the user's movement. But again, this is something that we also have a parallel in original 508 that talks about textual equivalent. But anyway, so in the understanding document that the W3C already provides, and they list examples of what do we mean by input that depends on the path of user movement. And one of the examples is a helicopter flight training simulator. So you meet success criteria 211 because it falls into this built into exception. So yes, they're covered, and yes, they can conform, and no, it's not a problem.
Okay, I'd like to thank Tim and Bruce for all the valuable information that they've shared with us today. And I'd like to thank those of you that joined us today for the webinar. And remember that we will be repeating this session on Thursday at 2:30. So if there are any of you feel the need to listen again, if registration is still open, because we've had a lot of interest in this session, so you may not, no longer, it could be full, but you could always check on that. And if not, remember that they are archived and tomorrow will be available for viewing. And that's all we have for today. I'm turning it back over to you, Claudia.
Thank you, Irene. With that, we'll conclude today's session. Just want to remind everyone that this archive will be posted at adaconferences.org/CIOC, and a copy of the PowerPoint will be posted along with the recording. To exit the webinar platform, click the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on the phone, just hang up. Thank you, and have a good afternoon.